Hi, folks, and thanks to the conference organizers. This has been a lot of fun so far, and great to see so many folks here. I wanted to start by trying to give an overview of some of the issues associated with the digital divide, talk specifically about some of the work that GeekCorps has done over the last 4 or 5 years, and then talk a little bit about some different strategies for working on the digital divide, particularly from an open source perspective. So let me start by talking about the term. Near as I can tell, the first use of the term digital divide was in 1998 in a report called Falling Through the Net. And this was a report that came out in the United States talking about the fact that it was far easier to get network access if you happen to be living in an urban area, if you happen to be wealthy, and you happen to be white. And concerns about this led to people in the U.S. and then people in Europe and around the world looking for ways to ensure that access to connectivity would actually be truly universal. We've got a huge problem to solve with this. According to NUA internet surveys, in late 01, early 02, we had an estimate of about 429 million people online at that point, which is about 6% of the world's population. We know that number's risen, but it hasn't risen all that dramatically. And we also know that there's an enormous disparity as far as who's online. In the US, in Canada, in Northern and Western Europe, generally we're dealing with a situation where about 1 out of 2 people have regular access to the net, either from their homes or from their offices. And when you start looking for public access through libraries, through schools, through other methodologies, you're up to close to 80 or 90%. In a lot of the parts of the world where I work, primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, you're talking about access more like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 3,000, 1 in 5,000, depending on where you're working. So you're really talking about technology being in the hands of a very, very small and very lucky elite rather than being in the mainstream. What's really interesting is that there's been a huge amount of interest in digital divide in the last 4 or 5 years. And for those of us who work in international development, it's been a bit surprising. You know, you think about all the different issues that a developing nation might face. Why is technology at the top of the tree? And a story that I heard from a South African colleague that I thought was rather wonderful was about development people who went into a fairly small rural village and said, look, we've got at least 3 projects we could work on. We could work on rural electrification. We could work on getting electricity to the village. We could work on a water project. We could work on getting more clean water here. Or we could work on telephones, and we could have access to the rest of the world. And the village sat down and took a vote and came back and said, let's get telephones. And the development guy said, why telephones? Don't you want water? Don't you want electricity? And the guy said, well, you know, once we have telephones, we can phone the government and tell them to get the water and the electricity here. So that's a pretty good example of how the power of communication comes into play. So some really tangible reasons why governments are reaching out and saying they want to work on digital divide. First of all, there's a realization that if you want to be part of a world economy, you need IT. Supply chains for industry and for retail have all gone online. And so if you want to sell to a global market, even if you're selling agricultural products, IT's become fairly critical. We've seen a huge growth in efficiency in the business climate in the US and Europe based on IT. And a lot of people in the developing world are interested in trying to get businesses to run more efficiently. We've all seen what happened when we moved business off of paper and onto electronic records. It's a huge growth. E-government is an enormous priority. In countries where we have problems with transparency and corruption, bringing government systems, registering for a license, registering for a permit online, gets rid of a lot of the opportunities for bribery and for corruption. And so that added transparency is a huge win. There's a lot of potential uses that we're just starting to see, like telemedicine and distance learning. The notion being that if you have really good connectivity, you may be able to access experts in other countries that you otherwise wouldn't be able to have access to. I'm going to offend my colleague from Bangalore here by referring to the Bangalore fallacy, which is what a lot of governments are now falling into the trap of. I've had at least 10 governments in the last 3 or 4 years tell me that they're going to be the next Bangalore. And the problem is, it's just not that easy. It took at least 30 or 40 years of reform in the Indian education system and a huge amount of investment to make this happen. But the hope is that outsourcing is going to be a source of income for at least some of the countries in which people like me find ourselves working. The digital divide isn't one divide. It's a set of divides. There's a massive infrastructural divide. We know that IT equipment, we know that networking equipment is priced out of the reach of a lot of people. And there really needs to be a way to build networks that are lower cost that get more users involved. But there's some other major divides as well. There's a policy divide. In a lot of developing nations, there's rules on the books that make it extremely difficult to innovate using new technologies and take advantage of new networks. There's a massive skills divide. And in a lot of countries where we're able to bring in computers and infrastructure, we're discovering that you also need to do a lot of work with skills training. Increasingly, we're seeing the importance of a language divide. A huge amount of software and a huge amount of the internet is in English, which isn't particularly useful for people who don't speak English. And there's a huge need to translate and localize content and tools to make them useful for people. Finally, there's an enormous relevancy divide. While the internet is very relevant to those of us who work in software and program computers for a living, there's real questions about how you deal with the relevancy of information to people who work in agriculture or work in manufacturing. How do you build applications? How do you build systems that help people live their lives better, basically using information? So there's been a lot of great work done on the infrastructure side. In fact, in any area, this is the area where I think there's the most to be proud of. There have been some terrific experiments with computer recycling. Two of the better ones we've seen, World Computer Exchange and Free Geek, both collect used computers, fix them up, generally put open source software on them. World Computer Exchange and Free Geek both put Linux on, and are shipping computers out in containers and selling for about a $30 to $60 price point in developing nations. And this makes it quite possible for a school, in some cases NGOs, to buy computers that they otherwise wouldn't buy. My colleague across the table has an amazing low-cost computing device, the Simputer. A lot of really creative work has been done building a handheld machine that's extremely, extremely powerful, very flexible, addresses a lot of the language and localization issues, and is also at a price point that people are able to afford. Brilliant work is getting done also in free networking. And again, to my right, we've got a fellow who's done terrific stuff in Namibia using a combination of telephone-based and wire-based networking to link up over 250 schools across a very, very large and very sparsely populated nation. So these are all approaches where we've had a great deal of success. There's a lot to feel good about. I'm going to make a quick counter-argument that infrastructure can't be the only thing we work on. And there's two quick counter-arguments here. One is that infrastructure has a way of taking care of itself, right? There's also a cell phone divide in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance. There's an enormous number of people who don't have access to telephones. But we've seen over the last year, as cell phones have come down in price, we've seen teledensity increase. And we're now up to the point where in South Africa, 14% of people have mobile phones. And in Ghana, where I do a lot of my work, which is a much, much poorer nation, we've gone from 10,000 mobile phones to 890,000 in 5 years. So basically from dead zero up to 5% of the population carrying mobiles. And this is purely via market mechanisms. And this is what's really interesting. When people discover that they have a need for technology and you can get it down to a reasonable price point, the market will do a lot of that work. Another case where I sort of want to flag infrastructure as being something you don't want to just do is talking about a project done by the World Space Foundation, which is a great organization. World Space uses satellite radio receivers to beam data down to people's PCs via an RS-232. What's great about it is that you're able to get access to data in the middle of anywhere, anywhere that's within the satellite footprint, which is brilliant. What's bad about it is it's unidirectional. And this sort of reinforces a paradigm that we see in a lot of infrastructure approaches, which is, let's just get information to people and then somehow their lives will be better. The truth is, as we think about building infrastructure, it's got to be bidirectional. We need people to be able to tell their stories and share their problems and share their questions at the same time. There's been a lot of talk, and actually a lot of talk at this conference as well, about policy approaches to digital divide questions. Obviously, there's been a huge amount of excitement over WISIS, World Summit on the Information Society. Excitement may be the wrong word. Policy is a critical problem to solve in solving digital divide issues. In a lot of countries, there are laws on the book that make it almost impossible to run the internet properly or efficiently. Again, turning back to Ghana, voice over IP is questionably legal. And a number of my friends found themselves arrested for terminating voice over IP calls, had the police come into ISP offices, seize all their equipment, detained for 3 or 4 days. And it's not that voice over IP is strictly illegal. It's just that no one's ever cleaned the laws up to the point where it was clear that it was legal or not legal. These issues happen all the time as technology starts colliding with old regulation. It's very exciting that we're looking at some of the global problems at WISIS and things like the ownership of ICANN and the domain name system and such, but this has the tendency to be a smokescreen because a lot of these problems are the problems individually in individual nations. And it's very, very hard to get people to face these problems. I'm working in Ghana right now on telecommunications reform, and the dominant telco, Ghana Telecom, has a lot to lose in the process. If we get voice over IP to be legal, they're going to lose millions and millions of dollars per year. So as policy reform happens, a lot of it has to be local. It's a difficult battle. There's a huge amount of vested interests in there. I'm going to skip the rest of this, but we can talk policy all day if we want. Most of the work that I've done in this field is based around the notion of skills transfer, and that's what Geek Corps, my former NGO, it's still an NGO, I'm no longer with it. We'll get into that in a moment. Skills transfer basically says as people start getting access to computers and infrastructure, there's a huge need for people to get the skills to handle the infrastructure themselves. There's a massive worldwide hunger for IT skills, and there's an incredible willingness to pay for it. We find even in desperately poor countries like Rwanda, people willing to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars a year to get an MCSE, to get Cisco certified, so on and so forth. And there's what ends up almost being an obsession with certification, this notion that what we really want is we want certificates and letters after our names so we can demonstrate that we're capable of doing something on a global scale. And this makes perfect sense. If you're trying to explain your competency to someone who doesn't know much about IT, it may not do a lot to tell them that you've worked on an open source project. It may make a lot more sense to say we've got a certificate. There are certification-based training methods that work quite well. Cisco Network Academies is extremely impressive. Cisco's invested tens of millions of dollars starting academies in amazing places. You find yourself in sort of the furthest corners of the world, and you'll find someone teaching Cisco routers. It's a great model up to a point. We founded Geek Corps with the notion that certification may not be the way to go, that IT in some ways is the last great apprenticeship industry. And I made this point to a colleague of mine yesterday, and he's a very distinguished university professor, and he pointed out that universities and PhDs are the other great apprenticeship skill set that we still have. But most people that I know learned their programming skills from another geek. And working alongside someone on a project and sort of inheriting skills basis there. That became the theory that we used for Geek Corps. One of the things we talk about a lot at Geek Corps is something that we call digital independence. And the idea is that we want to see nations get to the point where they're capable to create, maintain, and customize their own tools. There's a history of what we call poison pill IT projects in the developing world, where someone hands over a system and says, here, we've just given you an accounting system, have fun with it. And when that system breaks, or when it needs to be expanded, or when someone needs to improve on it, no one's there to do it, and you end up paying for experts to come back from Europe or for the US to do it. It's a very conscious business strategy. We're trying to break this cycle. We're trying to get to the point where in developing nations, there's a strong, diverse IT sector. People who can program, who can do web development, who can do databases, interface, testing, et cetera, et cetera. And commitments by people who are putting together projects, which is usually the government, to use that local labor force to do it. Now, the problem here is that in many cases, in a lot of the countries we work in, there's no IT sector competent to do that work at this point. And that's the problem that Geek Corps has chosen to focus on, is to try to build up that skills base of the local commercial IT sector to the point where people can take on those projects. The way that we've done this historically is one-on-one training, taking a volunteer from the US, Europe, Canada, bringing that person over to a developing nation for 4 to 6 months at a time to work within an IT firm on skills transfer. We've been doing this since 2000. It's put together by a bunch of US.com veterans with a lot of people who also worked in international development. We've worked in 12 countries at this point. Most of the projects have been in sub-Saharan Africa. A lot of work in Mali, Senegal, Ghana, Rwanda, but as diverse as Armenia, Mongolia, Jordan, an extremely wide range of countries. Weirdly enough, we've managed to be successfully funded by the U.S. government for the last 3.5 years. And I expected this to be incredibly difficult and a major crisis. Actually, it's what sort of kept our head above water. And I've been pleasantly surprised by it. We promote the model on a website, talking to people at conferences, looking for people who may be looking to take time off. We identify projects in a country. We write out very detailed scopes of work. And we do this either with staff on the ground or with sort of experienced geek volunteers who've already gone over, who we tend to refer to as Uber geeks. Thomas Krause sitting up in front is a good example of this, someone who volunteered with us several times and then ended up serving with us in Armenia, just identifying the next set of projects. Usually we deploy geeks together in teams. We send 4 or 6 people at a time, different skill sets. We might send someone who's very strong on graphics, someone else who's strong on C++, so that people can work on each other's projects. We always have our volunteers partnering with at least 2 people at the business that they're working with. And the idea is that we know that as we train people within a business, people are going to quit and get better jobs. And so the idea is we want to be training as many people as possible within that business so that the business holds on to the skills. Average age is about 31. Got a lot of European geeks, more men than women, unfortunately, which tends to be typical of the industry, wide range of skills that we're looking for. In particular, anyone who speaks French fluently, there's a desperate need for you right now with projects in Senegal and Mali. We're working on a project in Mali that's doing wireless networking to community radio stations. In Mali, you have a huge geographic area, you've got very low literacy, you've got a huge rural population. Community radio is the single best way to get information out. The problem is, you've got a radio station, where do you get your information? How do you find information to share with the world? We've seen radio stations in Mali where people are reading a medical textbook from the 1950s, and that's the content on the radio. So the goal is to get a simple digital editing station based around Dynabolic within each of these radio stations, and then use these huge 30-meter masts to be able to do point-to-point Wi-Fi over 50 kilometers. So we're starting in Bamako. We're now going site to site from there. That project's going to be running for the next 3 years. And again, we're looking for particularly Francophone wireless geeks. So if you fit that model, let us know. Very, very quickly, I left Geek Corps in early April, which makes it very awkward for me to sort of give a presentation from Geek Corps. But it's a sort of good perspective to tell you what's worked and what hasn't worked about the model. It turns out that sending volunteers overseas is really powerful in terms of one-to-one experiences. You build relationships that tend to last for years and years, and a lot of our geeks are still in touch with people that they've worked with. We also find that it's really changed the lives of a lot of the people who have participated. We've actually seen a lot of people go into Geek Corps, end up sort of moving out of mainstream software development and sort of moving into IT for development. So we've ruined more than one life. People who had nice lucrative careers are now spending all of their time bouncing about Africa and the Middle East. It's also a terrific reality check for people in developing nations to find out what's really involved with building software. The bad thing about Geek Corps turns out that it's just really expensive. When you're putting people on airplanes, it's an extremely, extremely expensive thing to do. Air tickets, insurance, keeping people housed and fed. You end up needing help from very, very large funders to pull it off. It's very hard to pull it off as a grassroots effort. In the course of 5 years doing this, I raised about $100,000 from individual donors and probably about $2.5 million from sort of major government donors. It's very hard to get individuals to sort of write checks to do this. This ended up with us having a falling out with a partner, and unfortunately most of the people involved with the project are no longer involved with it. That said, there's some great Geek Corps projects in Senegal and in Mali. There's also some terrific other organizations, UNITAS, which is the UN's Technical Volunteering Corps, NetCorps Canada and NetCorps Americas, which do volunteering in the Americas, which I'm happy to talk to people about. Ultimately, I think what went wrong with Geek Corps, and this will be the last thing I talk about, is that Geek Corps is essentially a consulting model. Every time we have to solve a problem, we have to bring someone over to solve it. And consulting is very useful in that you get very good hands-on service, but it doesn't scale well. When you want to solve two problems, you need two consultants. 10, you need 10 consultants. The great thing about software, if you do it right, is that if you solve a problem well, you solve it once, and then you've solved it more or less forever. You have to maintain it, you have to extend it, but the solution that works for one person might well work for 10,000 people. We figured this out fairly early on. We had a hard time implementing it. There's whole aspects of international development that make it very, very hard. You tend to get funded for one country and one problem. It's very hard to say, you funded me to work in Mali, but I'm going to solve this problem for all of Africa. It's very, very hard to get people to make that commitment. What I'm really excited about is a new wave of people thinking about sort of software-focused e-development projects. And the idea being, taking some of what we learned from Geekcore, working people one-on-one, tight partnerships between really experienced developers and the end users, a lot of collaboration, but the goal being to design software, not just to solve a specific problem. Gunnar and Katrine from Aspiration Tech are hanging around at this conference. They're doing a lot of work right now trying to figure out what's out there as far as software that's been designed for one purpose that could be useful on a global scale. And also, what are some of the unsolved problems? If you were going to go after a software for development-based approach, what are the problems that you would try for first? So, you know, keep an eye open for those guys as well. I'm going to shut up now, having taken a lot of time, but thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Ethan, for this overview and this inside view of your project and the also the problems and the big chances in it. Before we have the possibility to put one or two or three questions, I have the duty to announce or put a question to you. Who's planning to go to a workshop on Sunday at the Technical University and wants to eat there, yeah, has to buy a lunch ticket. So, but we can collect now the number of people and you can buy it later. So how many people are planning to go on Sunday to a workshop? It's a workshop about where next for copyright in Europe or the VSIS meeting or the Wikipedia Community Day. Who's going to plan there and want to eat? One. One, two. Two meals to reserve. Okay, thanks a lot. So do you have questions, remarks, comments on the presentation of Ethan? No? Okay, then. Okay.
Anupurbo is a wireless expert in Indonesia. Dr. Anupurbo is doing some of the most innovative work as far as informal and, frankly, illegal wireless networks. He's an amazing innovator as far as sort of looking for solutions to getting people on the internet in a country where the dominant telco is really trying to keep people on the internet.
Will they ask another question, please?
Yeah, may I ask you to add an information to the figures you gave? It's about gender and age. Because you're mentioning at the end that the Geekorgs, that the Geekorgs is between 25 and 35 and mostly male and so on and so forth. But what about the populations you are targeting, the population you are working with? Have you have a methodology or can you add some figures or do you have these figures?
I don't have exact figures on the populations we've worked with. I'm just sort of trying to give you a sense for who are the people who've gone over on volunteer tours. We work primarily with small software businesses. Those software businesses tend to be dominated by young men, which tends to be the trend of the IT world. One of the things that we've done sort of addressing the gender issue is we've tried very, very hard to make sure we have good female representation in our groups of geeks going over. We've actually done, sort of very pointedly and politically, a couple of tours that have been majority female to sort of try to make the point that there's a lot of terrific female IT talent. We've also done a lot of work trying to identify women-owned IT businesses to partner with. There's a very small number of possible partners at this point. It's been an issue for us.
Last question, please.
Yes. you in the first quarter of your talk, you brought the example of the African village where the elders were asked if they would prefer electricity, water, or connection to information technology, and you said they prefer the information technology so that they can connect with the government, that they can be heard. In your experience, does this model really work? So if there's a small, forgotten rural village in Africa, in some country in Africa, and all of a sudden they have the possibility to make a direct phone call to the government, does this really have any effect, or doesn't the government ignore them in the end anyway?
There's a terrific example in India with Mike Best's Sari project, which did a lot of wireless and sort of kiosk-based networking. And what he's discovered is that being able to essentially put problems in front of the regional government is the most popular application he's offered on his system. And what he's seen is that because these complaints are filed publicly and people can review whether they get taken care of or not, they actually get acted on a whole lot faster than complaints filed in any other fashion. So actually, he's had a tremendous degree of success as far as getting the regional government to work on things like resurfacing roads and repairing water pumps simply based on an IT-based system. So yes, we do have some evidence that it works. Is it working across the board? No, of course not. But there are a number of cases where we see some pretty good evidence that it is happening.
Just if I'm allowed a follow-up question, the effect of this being able to publicly address regional governments or the government on a national scale, isn't a prerequisite for that a certain percentage of the population has access to information technology? If it's very isolated insulas, this village or that village that is now able to contact the government, but if there's not really a whole connected public, then where's the pressure coming from?
The pressure comes from the fact that it's clear that the complaint was made. You're able to see it throughout the entire region of people who are reviewing that bulletin board. It allows you to put pressure on those regional officials. I agree with you. It doesn't work particularly well if you do a single village. In the Sari project, they did an extensive deployment throughout an entire region, which had a lot to do with the effectiveness of the program.